Well, welcome. Good evening. To the beginning of this class series, we'll have 7 weeks we can explore this book, Awakening. And it has, I think it has 14 chapters, so we can see what happens. But I thought what we might do is just so as to not rush through, spend like a week on per chapter, and just go through the first 7 chapters, and then maybe we continue the other ones later. it's a wonderful book, I think. And in past class series, I think maybe all the class series I've offered here at the Zen Center have been commenting on and teaching some traditional Buddhist text, like an Indian sutra, or the a Zen essay by Dogen Zenji, going through these classical Buddhist texts, which I love very much. So this is something new. This is something different for me, and maybe for you, is to pick up this like really contemporary expression of Dharma by Rodney Smith, who's a Vipassana teacher. He's a Buddhist teacher in the Theravada Vipassana tradition, which is not exactly Zen. But his presentation of Dharma in this book, I feel like is just universally Buddhist, and even beyond Buddhist, as he says, it's just spirituality and awakening in general. And within Buddhism, I feel like, even though he's a Theravada teacher, the emphasis in this book is I feel like a very Mahayana emphasis. It's really about non-duality and non-separation. We have an annual theme for this year at Santa Cruz Zen Center, which is non-separation. And there's even a chapter in this book called Living Non-Separation, which is a word that doesn't come up maybe in print so much. So I thought this is the perfect book. And Patrick and I are just returning from a 3-day conference in San Jose called the Science and Non-Duality Conference, SAND for short. And it was a lot of fun, and many, many different speakers, hundreds of different presentations on non-duality from both spiritual perspectives and science perspectives of physics and biology, and all kinds of different angles on this simple reality of unity and non-separation that is what is happening right here and now, this very presence. And so as I looked again at this book this evening, I thought, wow, this sounds like it's right out of this Science and Non-Duality Conference. It's very much in accord with everything we were hearing this weekend. And I feel like this weekend's event was a great inspiration and kind of confirmation that we're on the right track when we're looking at non-separation and non-duality. Many, many people interested in this topic, thousands of people at this conference, trying to find a more whole way of living and being free and happy, even if it's through science. So I hope this book will be a real opening into this. I feel like it's a detailed exploration, but it's not getting into a lot of technical Buddhist vocabulary almost at all. And anytime you feel like it's getting confusing or you don't understand something, let you raise your hand and let's stop, and we'll all get on board and stay on the same page. So Rodney Smith, this book is pretty new, I think, in the last couple of years it came out. Awakening, A Paradigm Shift of the Heart. Rodney has another book called Stepping Out of Self-Deception, an earlier book, The Buddha's Liberating Teaching of No Self. And I think I haven't read this whole book, but it seems like there's a lot of overlap. But I just thought at the very beginning, to help set the stage, there was a piece in here that I came across that I thought I might just share before we get into the book of this class. This is a section on realizing the potential of lay life. So Rodney Smith was a Buddhist monk in Thailand for a little while, and then he returned to America and returned to being a lay person and worked in hospice to benefit people in hospice for many years as a job, but practicing very seriously Buddha Dharma at the same time. And so he's a big exponent for lay practice, and maybe even slightly poo-poos the kind of monastic way, which he's, I think, legitimately can do because he did live that way. So maybe not exactly poo-poos, but really, really promotes the value and potential of lay practice in the world outside of monasteries as a potential for really complete awakening. And here Rodney says, there are three ways that lay Buddhism is inhibited, or lay practitioners actually feel inhibited from the full expression of practice and realization. The first is the belief that monasticism and long retreats are the only way to realize one's true nature. So, I don't know if any one of you holds that kind of view. Sometimes I can get into that view myself. Living both I feel like in a way, although I'm a priest, I'm living a kind of a lay lifestyle. Since I left Tassajara and Green Gulch Farm, these kind of monastic communities, maybe it's sort of like something in between because I come to the Zen Center every day. But anyway, I feel like it's a lay life in the complications of the world of things that everyone has to deal with, like livelihood and relationship and shopping and these kinds of things, right? So lay Buddhism can be inhibited by the belief that monasticism and long retreats are the only way to realize one's true nature. Because a common conscious or unconscious view that lay people maybe have is like, well, I can practice a little bit, but if I was really wanted to do it all the way, I'd have to go to the monastery. So he wants to debunk this. He goes on to say that all divisions, for example, between like lay life and monastic life, are attempts to keep us from the truth of what's right here. When this is understood by the sincere practitioner, there can be no more hesitation, no more postponement, and no more pulling back and waiting for a more opportune time. It's literally now or never. That's, I think, a great encouragement to practice. It's never like we're waiting for when we can finally do that retreat and get out of all these distractions. This is it. Every moment is an opportunity for practice and awakening. He goes on, breaking this hesitation allows psychic energy to flow into the moment and transforms our ordinary existence into the sacred. Suddenly, the Buddha is found in the middle of relationships, work, and family. Within all activities, reactions, thoughts, and emotional responses, nothing is outside now because no boundary is drawn to separate now from then. The message of the Buddha is equally relevant in all locations and at all times. Until this is fully realized, and until there's no movement to escape this environment for a better spiritual setting, we will continue to suffer. Good one to remember. This is it. There's never a better environment than the one we're in. Even if it's like, this is pretty peaceful tonight, we're at a Zen center and a Dharma class. But in the middle of our chaotic lives also, right, every moment's an opportunity. I think that's what he's really encouraging us to take up. So that's the first way that lay Buddhism may be inhibited by this belief. The second way lay Buddhism is inhibited is through misunderstanding the teaching of the long-enduring mind. Buddhism is full of metaphors of time that disarm us. For example, the Buddha says, "You have cried more tears than the waters of the great oceans," speaking of the endless lifetimes of inconceivable numbers. So we think that it's too big a project, this awakening business. It's too much for us. It takes too long. And especially in our busy life, we're so distracted from practice. Again, I think it's related to the first one. Is that we need to have this concentrated focus on nothing but practice in this particularly kind of contrived environment where everything is supporting us to do that, because it's going to take so long and such a big project. So again, he wants to debunk this by just every moment, again, is an opportunity for practice. There's no time that's just wasted in opportunity. And a third way we can inhibit a lay approach to spiritual fulfillment is by investing the sacred within particular practices and conditions. So this is like practice is only happening when it's in the zendo and we're wearing special robes and chanting special chants and there's incense burning, and it's the kind of sacred setting is where practice really happens, and it needs these kind of special sacred conditions. He goes on, "The lay Buddhist begins to recover the sacred in the most remote areas of her life, in the midst of difficulty and dissatisfaction, loneliness and despair. The reality of problems is challenged and investigated, and life begins to thrive free of circumstances and conditions. The heart takes over and is resurrected from the conditioned habits of mind." So it's maybe kind of similar to the monastery as the special environment, having the practice has to look this kind of sacred, special, holy sort of way, and that forms of practice have to be like Zen forms, as opposed to anything in our life can be a form of practice. And this book really opens up practice in this way that it doesn't even necessarily mean like quiet meditation. It's really about investigating every moment. So, awakening, a paradigm shift of the heart. I had to look up paradigm. It's a word we don't use that much. It means something like a model or a standard or a framework. So, like a shift of model of what the heart is. And I think at some point he says heart and mind are somewhat interchangeable here. And mind doesn't mean our intellect, and heart doesn't mean our emotions. I think this heart-mind here is bigger than both of those. And it expresses itself as conceptual thoughts and as emotions, but it's like the source. This heart-mind is like the source of thoughts and emotions. So a shift of our framework or our model or standard or paradigm for what is this heart or mind. And that's what awakening is, awakening or enlightenment in Buddhism. So I thought what we could do is at least for now, and this is the plan I thought we could do each week, is I'll pull out excerpts from each chapter and collect them here. So if you don't have the book, you don't have to buy it. I think the whole book is great, and so it's a nice, I recommend it because there's a lot of stuff besides this one page in the chapter where it goes into detail, but like these are kind of some key points, and I thought we could read them out loud, and then within each chapter, a really nice partly why I chose this book is there's these kind of gray square areas that are like experiential exercises, like kind of hands-on investigation. So I thought we could read them, actually sit silently with them and actually try out the exercises and talk about them. Yes?
A question about the titles.
Yeah.
Is it awakening that it is the, what is opposite of asleep? I mean, that's the paradigm shift.
Mm.
Just that it is, it's the awakening.
Yeah, you could say awakening has the sense of like not sleeping. Sleeping kind of implies not paying attention to what's happening, being kind of dull and confused. But in fact, awakening is a nice translation of this word bodhi. When the Buddha spoke about his enlightenment or awakening under the bodhi tree, the term that he used various terms, but one term he used was bodhi, which is closely related to Buddha. I'm not sure grammatically what the difference there is, but they both have this root of related to the English word bud, or budding, like which is kind of like opening, like a kind of a beautiful flower that's kind of closed but has all this potential and is just kind of ready to open. This is kind of like awaken. So in the word enlightenment, that's got, I think, more became somehow popular in our English language, is a very strange word that apparently was coined in like the 1800s by some early Buddhist translators, and maybe trying to relate it to the European Enlightenment, which is kind of like a sort of renaissance of thought and culture. It has some, I think it, the word has some virtues, like light is a nice metaphor for awakening, bringing light to darkness. But it's a little bit abstract. And I think awakening is a more accurate translation of bodhi and Buddhahood. And it could mean like awakening from sleep, or, you know, coming into full realization. Awakening from sleep is kind of like realizing what's happening here and now, which we didn't when we were asleep. There's something about awakening, yeah. So it's, you know, it's a big topic. You could say that's the, if Buddha means awakened, then we could say Buddhism is awakeningism, or awakenism. It's the religion of awakeness, awakenism. So this awakening is really the center of this spiritual tradition that we call Buddha, Dharma, and Zen. And we talk about it some, but here's a whole book that goes like right to the heart of the matter. What is awakening? And how can we realize it? It's not a theoretical book either. It's not just explaining what it is. It's like, this is what it means, and we can do it. And we don't need a monastery or special sacred forms even to do it. We can use those things. We love to use sacred forms, particular special forms in a Zen center. We can use those too. But this is a kind of a 24/7 possibility. Any other questions about this so far? Yes?
Well, just to go on with that, and maybe it's in this next few paragraphs, but we're talking about awakening to the true nature of reality. Is that...
Yeah, you could say, what are we awakening to?
Buddha's awakening was...
Yeah,
too.
We could call it many names. Awakening to... awakeness, awakening to the true nature of reality, awakening to non-separation or non-duality, awakening to the true nature of heart or mind, awakening to love. I think all of these words we can use for what we're awakening to.
To our own true nature.
Our own true nature, which could sound kind of abstract, but truth or reality. I mean, some people might feel like that is a realm of like philosophy, truth or reality, and some people with a philosophical bent might be like, my what I really want to do in this life is to understand truth or reality. And I feel like that way. I care what is true and real and want to be in accord with reality and not fool myself, right? But some people might feel like, I don't necessarily care about what's true and real. I just want to be happy. So I think that's another name for truth or reality is true happiness or contentment or peace. So that's another way to say it. Our true nature is, from a psychological point of view, we could say it's happiness and peace and completeness, fulfillment in an unconditioned kind of way. But if we, from a philosophical point of view, we could call it truth or reality. From a kind of metaphorical view, we could call it awakening from sleep. Yes.
We have to love life more than the meaning of it. The meaning that we impute to it, that we think we know, and we really don't. And just give up our search for meaning and just be.
Yeah, so that is the theme of this book, is how we attribute meaning falsely and it hinders our just being. Yeah, so many things will be unpacked here. So instead of just starting with chapter one, I thought the introduction to the book was quite inspiring, I thought. And this is sort of like a little pep talk. And when I read this, I thought, wow, yeah, this is the book. So maybe you can just read this out loud, and you could read a paragraph, and then we'll stop and see if there's any questions or discussions, and then we can continue. We could start with Corinne, and we could go around like this. Could read a paragraph?
You want me to?
Yeah, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. Many of us do not understand what spiritual transformation requires. We may think of it as a slight alteration or derivation from our normal routines, or perhaps merely an inconvenience. Life after this adjustment will go on pretty much as before, though we will be wiser and more judicious in our actions of body, speech, and thought. If we follow the Buddhist path, we may have a more penetrating understanding of the causes of our conflicts and torments. We may perceive our motivations and thoughts with more subtlety and generally live in a lighter, more joyous manner. These are the adaptations that occur when anyone allows the Dharma to affect his or her consciousness, but they are not the full story. The transformation that I am referring to in this book is a complete shift of paradigms, a total reorganization of perception. It is not an adaptation, but a merging with and an abiding within reality.
Whew. I thought that was, you don't hear that kind of thing so much, right? Because it talks about the, I mean, we might feel this way, right? If we follow the Buddhist path, it may have these benefits, right? A more penetrating understanding of the causes of conflicts and suffering, and we can perceive our motivations and thoughts more and live in a lighter, more joyous manner. We might say, that sounds good enough for me. That sounds great. And I think it is great, right? And we might feel like that's what it's all about. I think many people might feel like that is good enough. And And I think this book does address this kind of thing. It can be taken on so many levels. And as he says here, these things are adaptations that occur when anyone allows the Dharma to affect his or her consciousness. So it's a plug for practice on any level will benefit us in these wonderful ways. And it's also saying, and we can keep going deeper than even living in a lighter, more joyous manner. We can have this total paradigm shift, a reorganization of perception. Is maybe kind of a strong way to put it. You might feel like, I don't know if I want my perception to be reorganized. How will I find my way to the door? Mm-hmm. So, yes?
He's kind of suggesting with that reorganization of our perception being our conditioned thinking.
Yes, exactly. Our conditioned thinking. And I think all the things he mentioned earlier as like, these are benefits that always come when we allow the Dharma to affect us. And I think it is, in a way, the book goes into the same themes, but just on a deeper level. I think it's not something completely different than living in a lighter, more joyous manner and understanding the causes of our conflicts and suffering. I think that is what the rest of the book is about, actually. It makes it sound like it's something way different beyond these, but I think really what he means is let's allow this to really pervade our whole lives completely. And that's a tall order. But I think I was really inspired by that because I think we can practice even for years and years in this way. Well, it does work some, and it's almost like we make Dharma practice into sort of like a hobby, sort of on the side. And because it does have good benefits, and we fit it in. I don't mean just like coming to Zazen, but like, you know, the whole package of Buddha Dharma transformation. We might like put in this category of like, you know, walking the dog, picking up some groceries, you know, spiritual transformation, yoga class, and so. Which I think is okay also, but this is, we can also see it as it can pervade all those other activities, right? It's this more, it's not just another thing on the list. We might say going to sit zazen at a certain time is one of the things on the list along with walking the dog and the yoga class. But Rodney here is not talking about just a 40 minute meditation period. He's saying how we can bring this investigation into our whole life, potentially. And of course, we're always, myself included, always forgetting. So this is helping clarify what we're doing in the investigation of truth and then remembering in Sangha and in community together, like this is how we can encourage each other. Yes.
I was dwelling on his use of the word adaptation as opposed to change.
Yes,
and
good one.
That I'm trying to think what he's saying is that, you know, when we have these beliefs, you know, the Buddhist path is good, it has certain great teachings, and I'm going to adapt my behavior to be close, more aligned to that, whereas the other, whatever, awakening is... Mm-hmm. Is different.
Not an adaptation. That's right.
It's a transformation.
Transformation, we could say. I think later there's a section in a further future chapter, a section called Adaptation versus Surrender. So that's another hint, maybe, about some differences. So let's keep going. Yeah.
This book attempts to explain genuine spiritual realization. When we speak of enlightenment and awakening, what do we mean? What actually occurs when we slip beyond consensus or conventional reality, the generally agreed upon reality of separate subjects and objects that most of us believe is the true perception of life? And why would we undertake such a journey? This book looks at the topography, of the journey from beginning to end, the multiple ways we undermine, the very growth we seek, the shift in consciousness that does occur, and the life that arises out of that shift. The book was written to unmask the process of awakening, to expose it completely and free it from cultural and arcane language. When Buddhist references are appropriate, they are used, but for the most part, this journey is unique to each traveler and therefore difficult to categorically map within any spiritual structure.
Right. He says elsewhere that, you know, Buddhism is his main tradition, so that's, he quotes the Buddha throughout, but he also quotes a lot of science, actually. There's a lot of sections on he's just, I think, a very curious guy and has, you know, heard these things that are alpha pointers from different traditions. So this part in parentheses here is the footnote in the back of the book about defining consensus or conventional reality, which he uses throughout the book. So I think that's an important term. Consensus reality or conventional reality is the generally agreed upon reality of separate subjects and objects that most of us believe is the true perception of life. That's the footnote definition. Yes?
There's such a vitality in his work. It's like more than the word, something beyond it.
Yeah, I think he's very enthusiastic and I think that partly why I was drawn to this book is I felt like it's not just like, yeah, here's some practices you can do and here's Buddhism. It's more like, come on, let's do it fully.
It's almost transmitting energy.
Yeah.
It's palatable.
Yeah, I think so. It's a nice introduction. I'll read another paragraph. The soul. Where these numbers are, by the way, I'll maybe just keep doing this system. These numbers are the page number of the book.
The sole prerequisite for joining this adventure is an enthusiasm and curiosity to know what is true rather than living with what is convenient and easy. But this single requirement seems to vastly limit the number of participants. The intended audience of this book is anyone who is hungry enough to question conventional assumptions and allow the truth to take us wherever it will. If we are motivated to know what is true, then let us dive into the mystery of life together and relish this joyful journey to fulfillment.
That's what the book was intended for, and we could say, should we have a prerequisite for this class of enthusiasm and curiosity to know what is true, rather than living with what's convenient and easy? And I said, well, no, I don't think we should have the prerequisite, but you might end up just, you know, losing interest and dropping out if without that. And I think this is generally true of Dharma. Yes.
Well, it's my first Zen class.
Yeah.
I'm over here bursting with enthusiasm because I've had some experiences in Marin in San Francisco Zen Center, and the formality, and not a class, but some of the services. And so I didn't know if I would feel welcome because I moved to this area in 2001 to study with Adyashanti. And so it's so beautiful and amazing that you're talking about this book and that you and your personality feel so light and open and kind of tickled by this. And this is how Adya teaches. And so for me, I'm just like, yeah, there's all kinds of enthusiasm I'm containing.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I mentioned, you know, I just came from this Science and Non-Duality conference where Adyashanti was one of the speakers.
Yeah.
So, And I think it's like I really appreciate that, you know, very non-denominational, non-religious kind of style of events like that. And in my personality, I also love the like super traditional formal Zen ceremonies as kind of like an art form, like an expression of that's what I think part of what it's not so much like the real spirituality is in that ceremony and you have to do that ceremony to get it. That would be a big misunderstanding that I think he's pointed out. But then we can use the forms also as a kind of like expression, which all these ancient traditions have, and there's something beautiful just in the very, to me anyway, it's beautiful just in the fact that they're ancient and they get passed along, because you feel this connection to all these past people who are celebrating the same kind of expression. But it's kind of like a personal taste thing. So for this class, we did do this opening chant. We have to excuse that. That ritual chant. We, at the beginning and end, we do this chanting, which I think is nice. But it's, you know, minimal form. And I think it's nice that we offer all the different styles of formless and formal. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'm not sure people know that Agya was in Zen for 14 years.
Yes.
So in his teachings is a great love for the tradition.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of it. Many, many expressions and many presentations. Thank you for that. So if this was like a, you know, a Dogen essay that we were pulling apart line by line with looking at all the Chinese characters and stuff, you might be already like heading for the door. You're like, wait a second, this is too like dusty and old and stilted and yeah.
I know that too.
Yeah, it's nice to know that too. This is, shall we continue? Another paragraph?
When we look out of our eyes, we see the world as we have been taught to see it. Our eyes organizing reality as objects distinct from the subject of me. The force of our conditioning holds us within this duality, and that conditioning acts as a substantial authority, unleashing our doubt if we stray too far away from what we have learned. Here is where science can help. It supersedes the educational imprint that has kept us confined within the logic of consensual reality. We were educated under the logic of the old science, and the new science is showing us a new perception that can arrest our doubt. We can now look out of our eyes and understand that although we perceive in a dualistic way, it is not the truth, regardless of what we have been taught to believe.
So, bringing science in there, which is, science is a big topic, and as I mentioned, Rodney Smith quotes a lot of different articles and scientific discoveries in the quantum physics world particularly, and this paragraph stands out especially to me tonight, just returning from the science and non-duality conference where they're very much about like bringing together scientific research and discovery into how things work with the ancient spiritual teachings, and seeing how there's a lot of overlap at this conference. Robert Thurman was one of the Buddhist teachers there, and he likes to emphasize that Buddha actually was a true scientist. He likes it, maybe particularly in this conference, but Buddha was in many things, a yogi, a meditator, a philosopher, but also a scientist in the sense of like science is like about testing hypotheses and seeing what comes out, especially testing them again and again, and in this case it's like testing to see how suffering arises and how contentment comes to be, these kinds of things. Also at this one actually it was a Zen teacher from New York at this conference quoted Max Planck. You know, Max Planck was one of the founders of quantum physics, and German physicist in 1931. And you hear these types of things, but this one, this quote, I hadn't heard this before. He said, Max Planck in 1931 said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental, and I regard matter as derivative from consciousness." Wow, what a direct, non-dual statement. That we hear this kind of thing, but that really, early on in this quantum physics movement, I regard matter, what we call matter, as derivative from consciousness. So that's an example of scientists starting to discover something about non-duality. Yes.
Which of his experiments caused him to say that?
I don't actually know enough to. I'm sure you can Google it, and I found this quote on Google, and I think I found there was an article that explained that quote from his scientific point of view too. So I didn't have time to look it all up. But like the Heisenberg principle, I think is mentioned in here, which I'm not have much knowledge of physics and science, but my very limited understanding of the Heisenberg principle is something like the observer always affects the outcome of the experiment. You can't have accurate data of an objective event without taking into account the observer, particularly in the world of quantum mechanics, quantum physics. And that's a kind of hint that there's some, we got it, we can't forget the observer or consciousness. And again, this spiritual teachers who were at this conference were particularly emphasizing the science part because it's a science and non-duality conference. But Francis Lucille, one of the great teachers there, somebody asked him about meditation and, you know, how do you practice meditation? Is there some technique about being really quiet and still? And his answer was, meditation is just a continuous experimentation and testing of hypotheses. That's what meditation is. It's kind of a surprising answer for that person and me. But I thought it was a nice way to look at this is the kind of inquiry type of meditation. It's a constant, he said too. With true meditation, we never stop this experimentation and testing of hypotheses. And spiritual hypotheses are like, are things separate from me? Are things what I think they are? These kinds of, I think they are what I think they are. That's my hypothesis, but let's test it through practice.
One, I can't remember which teacher, Zen teacher, had the question, how do I know this is true? What I'm thinking, hearing, believing. How do I know what I think about it is what's truly there?
Mm.
Experience what I'm experiencing.
Yeah. How can I know it's true? Byron Katie is into that inquiry too. Is it true? How can I know it's true? And how would it be if it wasn't true?
I think it wasn't true.
And especially true things like I'm an unworthy person,
yeah.
Things like that. So this teacher Francis Lucille, his teacher Jean Klein, they're both Frenchmen. Kind of non-dual practitioners. Jean Klein said, philosophy, which the word philosophy actually means love of knowledge. Sophie, right? Philosophy is love of knowledge. And he said, philosophy is the science of happiness. Which is another way to look at science, in a way we don't usually think of, but the science of happiness. And you could say this experimentation of meditation practice, being experimentation, is all about the science of happiness. And in fact, going back in to the generation before that, this Frenchman Jean Klein is the one who actually went to India and met his teacher there, and he was looking for a spiritual teacher, and I think he might have been a physicist or some kind of scientist, so he had that kind of scientific method, and he said, this is how I'm going to find my teacher. I'm going to ask whoever I meet these three questions, and depending on how they answer them, that person will be my teacher. It's kind of scientific method. I thought this was a nice story. The three questions are you happy? And so he asked this Indian teacher, are you happy? And the teacher said, yes. And then the second question was, does your happiness depend on anything, on any particular conditions? The teacher said, no, it doesn't.
Like wealth or relationships.
Yeah, wealth or relationships or health or you know, anything.
Good air day.
What's that?
Good air day.
Sun shining. Warm and all. No, it doesn't depend on that. And the third question is, can you teach me this happiness? Mm-hmm. He said, yes, I can. He said, okay, you're my teacher. Kind of scientific method. Let's read another paragraph. Yes.
Our current paradigm has an all-encompassing logic that is based upon the premise of separation. The I, the subject, and having the experience of distinctly separate objects, and the universe is divided into a multitude of isolated forms. We rarely challenge this premise because our direction within life rests upon its certainty, and everyone seems to be acting as if it were true. But just because everyone seems to be acting in accordance with this premise does not make it true, and science is showing us that we need an updated paradigm.
Makes sense? I mean, we might say, well, what, it's not true that actually that me over here is separate from a multitude of isolated forms. Of course, the whole rest of the book is going to be starting to explore this, so we might have some question. I think it would be normal to actually question that, because it is the consensus paradigm. I'm over here and things are separate from me, meaning that they're not me, right? And everyone seems to be acting in accord with this. And I would say, even if we've, you know, which probably most of us have in this room, heard this kind of thing many times, and we know that actually I know things are not really separate. I know that's the old paradigm. I'm over that, we might say. We might all be in that category of intellectually understanding this, right? So, but it's not just about understanding it as like conceptually or intellectually. Even if we're convinced in that way, how do we open to this reality in our actual like heart and our life, and like live the reality of non-separation? That's where like the rubber hits the road. It's where, and so I think this book will get into this kind of thing too. It's there's a practice involves this kind of cognitive questioning and experimentation. The scientific method is kind of like that, but also, you know, bringing that into our lived experience. And that's actually the much harder part. How about, jump down to the floor. Readers, are they?
This book proposes that we do just that, update our paradigm for a variety of logistical reasons, from political domination, population expansion, and resource diminishment, to climate devastation. The time is ripe for a new paradigm. But beyond the human drama and need, science is proving our current reality false. It is revealing truths that are new only to us, but have been present and active since time immemorial, and we have simply been unable or unwilling to experience them. It is like fish suddenly perceiving the water they swim in. As shocking as that might be when first understood, it really changes nothing. The fish go on swimming within a media that is now made conscious to them. Discovering the mutability of time, space, knowledge, and separation does not change the underlying reality of what has always been. It simply opens a new potential and configuration within that reality.
So I think that's a nice point that we're not like manipulating the world somehow to change around and turn into something else. It's anything that we could call truth or reality must always already be the case. So it must be something about our perception, he mentioned. It's a reorganization of perception. And I think we could use that word, but it's not exactly like, depending what we mean by perception, it's like, right now we see things and hear things and taste things and feel things. That's like, we could say is part of perception. And of course, with awakening, all of that kind of perception continues. So it's not like perception exactly changes, depending on how we define it. But I like the word perspective. I would say awakening is a complete shift of perspective, because we're still perceiving things in a similar way that we are now, but the perspective changes, like these optical illusions, you know, where you can see, you're looking at it and you see these two faces, and then something shifts and you see the vase instead. You know that one classic optical illusion. You could say it's not really a shift of perception. Some people might call it that, but I would say it's a shift of perspective. You're seeing the two faces or the vase, and you can shift the perspective back and forth. Perspective is, I guess you could say, like, where we see from, something like that. Or understanding. You could, shift of perspective is kind of like shift of understanding. And like fish suddenly perceiving the water they're swimming in. And I think this is a good point. They bring in science here, because science really is like that, right? That we get new information constantly as science improves. So things like quantum physics, nobody would have believed that before the experiments were done, and now it's like kind of convincing. And to go back even further, we know there was this time, or we've heard there was this time, when like the majority of people in the world thought that it was flat, right? Like that seems absurd to us now, but as I understand it, like most people really thought that's how it was, because you can only see that far, and it doesn't look bulbous, right? It just looks flat. And then scientists discovered, quite a while ago, they discovered that actually it's not flat, it's round. And I think there might even have been that was like heresy, and I think some of those people who started claiming the earth is round might have gotten arrested, things like this, because it's like you're crazy and you're trying to convince good, sane people of this crazy idea that the earth is round. But then of course then that becomes the dominant paradigm slowly over time, that the earth is round, and then now we think it's absurd that people thought it was flat, but they really didn't think it was absurd then, which is a nice clue that maybe things we just completely take for granted now will be revealed to be completely false. We could say that's awakening. Yeah.
So, what coming up for me with this paragraph is that, and this part of the discussion, is that it's not that, you know, the consensus, you know, perception is false. It's just not everything. It's not that the world doesn't appear flat.
Uh-huh.
It does, mm-hmm. up to a certain point. Mm-hmm. Because it reminded me of a children's book. I think she must have lived in a dollhouse, and all of her life she thought the sky was yellow with blue flowers. And then she was brave one day and went outside, discovered it was something else.
But that, something more complete. That's a nice point, that it's not necessarily completely false. It's just incomplete. Yeah, nice. And you use the word, it appears that way. So in Buddhism we talk about the consensus or conventional reality. It can sometimes be called apparent reality. The reality of appearances. And the Buddha didn't deny the way things appear. And sometimes it would even like contrast, there's the appearances and the reality. Or we could say the apparent reality and the complete reality. But appearances have a kind of reality. Like the appearance of separation, we can't deny that it seems like I'm over here and you're over there. But it really appears that way, and we honor that as like the apparent reality. But it's not the complete reality. Yeah, that's a nice point. Yes?
My thinking is that we all have patterns that we've developed in our lives that make us feel secure and stable, that ways of getting love from people and from the environment. And there are some cases, like, suppose you were a person who were rejected a lot when you were growing up. So and you're used to being rejected. So then you go into the relationships and you set it up so you're always getting rejected because that's what you're used to. So it's like your form of happiness is actually suffering because that's what you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
So
And your reality is that I am and always will be rejected, even though you kind of set it up yourself.
So this awakening is almost, it takes courage to look and see what patterns you've sort of bought into in order to feel secure.
Totally, yes. And that's where this starts to go now, too. Yes, exactly as you say. Here's the first exercise. So I put between these lines here is the kind of gray-shaded areas in the books. This is on page 18. Ari, you want to read this one?
Try this exercise. Do not authenticate the perception of separation, but simply try to feel what comes forth when you believe in this way of seeing. Feel the pain inherent in seeing the world as outside you, being cut off and isolated. Thinking the world is separate forces you to use the world to satisfy your desires, so tension comes into play. You must also shore up your defenses and security so the world will not overwhelm you, and therefore fear arises. On and on the layers of pain accrue until you are willing to seek a true and natural relationship with reality. You will discover that many of the emotions you take for granted originate from thoughts of separation.
So here's the exercise, and where it says, do not authenticate the perception of separation. I think authenticate means like verify or confirm. It's not necessarily like we have to really believe that separation is true. But try to feel what comes forth when you believe that things are separate. So maybe we could just for like, you know, a half a minute or something, just sit quiet, actually try this exercise, right? This exercise is a little bit like reverse practice. Maybe I shouldn't call it that. It's because it actually is practice. The practice of not trying to end the perception of separation, but really feeling the implication, really kind of get into how we do feel that things are separate. And even if we feel in this room right now that we're pretty settled, maybe remember like a fight or something, or a difficult situation where you really feel separate from somebody else or something else, and feel the impact of this belief in separation. so it's not the most fun kind of practice. But I think it's nice to actually taste that the painfulness of this, or this consensus paradigm of separation. If you had a hard time getting into it just now, you will have many chances in your daily life to feel this pain, right? So when it arises, just to really like actually feel the pain, and then and you could even say anytime you feel pain, that's what we're talking about. And but then to notice that at that time that I am holding a view of separation between myself and another, often between myself and another person. And really like make that connection really strong. In other words, I think this is a beautiful paragraph because this tension comes into play and we shore up our defenses so that nothing will overwhelm us. And often we like blame others and say, this is not about separation, it's about them being wrong or obnoxious, right? So really feel like the bottom line is actually, I really believe the other is separate from me. I think it's a great practice exercise, and of course it happens all the time. And I think also if we don't do this, if we don't kind of acknowledge the pain of separation, then we don't have much motivation to practice. We maybe try to forget about it. I think my life's going pretty well, and like, why would I need to practice? But I think most practitioners, the greatest practitioners, including the Buddha, right? This is what drove him to practice. It wasn't like, everything's cool in my life, but like, let's just go explore some mind states. It was more like, actually, you know the Buddha story, the classic story. It was a nice one too, because he had, externally, he had everything he wanted, right? He had this great family, this great all privilege, power, wealth, health, youth, everything you could want, but he still was, I'm still not really content. So therefore, he knew he couldn't blame it on the external conditions. That's why I think that maybe the Buddha progressed so fast. He kind of got over the blaming part from the get-go, because everything was seemed to be fine externally. So, but he had to really feel that discontent with just being a conditioned human being. And another thing that stood out. This is a little, you know, impressions from this conference this weekend too. Rupert Spira, a great teacher, was speaking there, and he and I think his teacher Francis Lucille were both there, and I think they both said the same point, which I thought was interesting, which was if we have a belief in separation, and I think they might have even used identifying with this body and mind as a separate self, but same thing as feeling separate from others. If we have that, there are inevitably, based on this belief, inevitably two consequences that are, you know, you cannot get around. And they are fear, and particularly fear of disappearance and death. This is a big one. You can say, and maybe all other fears are sort of derivative of this basic fear that I'm a separate being, and if I am this body and mind, I, my true self, am going to die, disappear, and die. And that you, if we feel and believe we are this separate body and mind, that fear on some level is inevitable. If we try to block it out, it's based on a delusion. And the other one is, besides fear, is lack. If we're a separate being, we will always feel like we're lacking something. And we need something outside us to fulfill the lack, because we're separate from, we are not the whole. And we might say, well, this basic, you know, very basic, almost existential fear and lack, well, isn't that just the human condition? We can't get over that, can we? But that's what's so radical about this proposition of awakening is that if we're identifying ourselves as a separate body mind person, then that's just the human condition. But through scientific experimentation, we can come to see that maybe my true identity is not actually the separate body and mind, separate from others. And therefore, we hear that the Buddha actually did not fear even the death of his body, and did not have a sense of lack of anything, even though he just had like one robe and one bowl, and had nothing, no possessions or, anything other than just himself, in a way. So I think that's a nice one to keep in mind. Again, if we feel like things are going pretty well, we can go deeper. Do I have any fear of disappearance or sense of lack and all the other problems that derive from these basic qualities of this belief, or results of this belief. And I think that this awareness of the pain of this sense of separation is really necessary for spiritual practice. Maybe not necessarily awareness of pain doesn't necessarily lead to spiritual practice, but making this connection between pain or suffering or discontent and the sense of separation. So that's what, right at the beginning here, that's what this first exercise was about, linking all our difficulties. Notice how whenever there's a difficulty, there is also this sense of separation, and really making that clear again and again. We can take that as a kind of homework because that's the fuel for practice. I think if we don't feel that discontent and make the connection that it's based on this particular perception, we just don't have enough motivation to practice, maybe any reason at all. But those of us in the room, I think we do have some sense of this already. But to keep reinforcing that as a kind of like, almost like bodhicitta, our fuel for practice, is partly about this. Let's keep going a little bit. Another paragraph.
To compensate, we seek to offset the sense of incompletion by searching for experiences that offer momentary gratification. We maintain the sense of an external world because it gives us an opportunity to compensate for the flaw of our own making, a flaw created by assuming separation. Much of our action becomes an attempt to remedy the stress of our misperceptions and thereby regain an innate ease and well-being. This works as long as we ignore what is driving our actions and refuse to question the assumptions behind them. The simple solution is to release the need to be separate, allowing the whole to re-emerge. Then the struggle would naturally resolve itself, but we have so much at stake in being separate that we forego the obvious. We have lived with this deficiency for so long, we think it is our natural condition and no longer understand it as a self-generated problem. Living within the view of separation requires us to project the pain of incompletion back onto the world so that we can be free of the consequences. We have developed an elaborate system of defenses to ward off the implication that there is anything wrong with the way we observe, other than unwanted and interfering circumstances that keep us from our goals. This has led to a culture that is very good at blaming and accusing others, but very poor at assuming any.
It's a good one, huh? Yeah. You mean it's not their fault that I'm not content? Yes.
The blaming thing is so interesting. The other day I was thinking about something from the past that I had always perceived as the problem was that this person had this problem. And for the first time I thought the problem was that I didn't know how to handle that person having that problem. So every situation is really the interconnected, the whole piece.
Yes.
It's like, no.
Yes. right? If you,
both of us.
If they were having that problem, like, across the street talking to somebody else, it would be like, yeah, that's not such a problem if they're that way, but they're that way to you. And you have to respond.
And I didn't know how to respond.
Yeah.
So that it was if I knew how to respond, it wouldn't
Yeah, that's a good one.
And so the fact that I didn't know how to respond created this system.
Yeah.
It's a system that that way it's, I mean, of course, it's for people, but within a system.
Yeah, yeah. But it, the one who doesn't know how to respond feels as if it's the separate self. Instead of just, maybe there could be a way where, with non-separation, we just let whatever response comes up in the moment. But when we feel separate, we feel like, I don't know how to do it, how to deal with this right now. We feel that separate contraction. And I have this obligation and responsibility to respond in the appropriate way, and I don't know how to do it. And all of that creates this tension of separation. And then because it's so uncomfortable, like, if only they weren't that way. Yeah, that's a great insight into how that works, the blame thing. And we've lived with this for so long that we think it's the natural condition, and we've developed an elaborate system of defenses to ward off the implication that there could be anything wrong with our perception. I think it's great language in here. You could kind of read through this again and again and really let it sink in. Yes?
I was just considering the not knowing how to respond there, and not knowing kind of freezes the energy, or can freeze the energy. And I was just considering how that not knowing relates to not knowing mind.
Big not knowing.
Yeah, big not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Which where one can relax.
Exactly, yeah. And true.
Instead of tightening up, I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, Yeah, which you could say is the not knowing from the point of view of non-separation is like reality, in fact, because we don't really know really anything that's going on, versus not knowing from the point of view of a separate self is very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And like we better figure this out quick. Yeah, yes.
And when we were going through that exercise, I thought it was interesting, this idea of separateness, like, in the sense that, like, the example I thought of was, like, maybe somebody that I felt attached to in a way, and it's like this idea of not being separate, not actually being separate isn't to actually be with them, it's something, like, really ineffable. Sort of, seems kind of
What that actually is?
Yeah, like, the actual not being separate is not the opposite of what's happening, in the sense that it's not like me being away from them, it's not me like sitting next to them and hanging out with them, right? It's something else that's much more, that's not effable.
Yes.
Impossible.
I think it is ineffable, and yet the rest of this book will, I think, try to keep hinting at this ineffable non-separation and what exactly that means. This is just getting into it. Yes, Ken?
I'm thinking of non-responding as a response. It's like approaching it with non-separation. You're just opening yourself up, and you're kind of merging into the problem rather than trying to create walls and divisions between the issue.
Yeah, sometimes non-doing is the response, or like, is that so? It's kind of like non-doing, right? And sometimes the response, sometimes non-doing is based on separation or fear, and it's time to do something. So there's no special formulas. It's getting time to stop. Do you have a quick?
A question. Non-separation is most intimate. Who said it? Was that Dogen?
Well, not knowing is most intimate is, I think, Fai Yan, Chinese Zen ancestor. Yeah, not knowing. Yeah. So you can read this last paragraph on your own. I thought that this part in parentheses is, again, it's not my note, it's a footnote, but I thought this is a nice definition of ego, which is a very vague term that can get tossed around, like, that's just your ego or whatever. So here, it's a nice definition of that. The ego is the voice inside our minds that comments and directs us through most events. It is a clear reference and sense of me, separate from what's not me. In the case of this book, that would be the definition of ego. And there's one more exercise we didn't get to that's the more fun one. So you can do it at home to make up for the non-fun one. Imagining as if there's nothing outside of yourself. So that's the first round. So if you have the book, you could read the introduction in chapter 1, and you could read chapter 2. So that might be a lot, but that's if you read the chapter ahead, then we can I'll bring highlights again next week. But then if you have questions that aren't on the highlights that you want to bring up about the chapter or chapter 1, you're welcome to bring them to next week. We'll continue.
Through chapter 2.
The grand continuous experiment will continue. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.